This week's The Interview is brought to you by AndrewandTodd.com. AndrewandTodd.com are the world's best lenders for real estate. They are with Sierra Pacific Mortgage. You can call them at 888-888-1172. And please do, no matter what your lending needs are, AndrewandTodd.com. And now welcome to this new edition of The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. The interview today is with Michael Punk. And Michael is a great novelist. I'm sure you read The Revenant. Maybe you saw the movie, but I hold in my hand The Perfect Father's Day Gift, Ridgeline, his brand new novel. It publishes now. You can order it in time for Father's Day on June 20th this year. Michael, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show, and thank you for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you very much. I'm excited that you enjoyed the book.
Oh, very much. Our mutual friend, Michael Duffy, arranged for that.
Exactly.
You to send this to me. And I, you know, I don't normally read historical fiction. I'm more of a nonfiction or a thriller person. But Michael said, you'll love this. I sat down and I couldn't stop reading it. And so right there, home run. But then let me count the ways of things I didn't know anything about. Red Cloud. I knew a little bit about Crazy Horse, the 1866 campaign. I didn't know. How did you know all this? I mean, did you decide first that you were going to write a novel about it and then learn, or had you learned and then decide to write a novel about it?
Well, I grew up in Wyoming, and this story is a little bit better known in Wyoming, although even there, it's not something that most people probably know about. But my when I was in high school, I had a summer job working at Fort Laramie National Historic Site, dressing up in an 1876 cavalry uniform and talking to tourists about the history of the American West. So I learned about some things that have always kind of been in the back of my mind, and I just thought this had such a great story and cast that it was perfect for a novel.
Is it fair to call the episode recounted in Ridgeline? And the trick with a novel is to give away a little bit, but not too much. The opening act of the Custer's Last Stand, is this really when it begins?
In a lot of ways, it is, in terms of the kind of defining decade of the Indian Wars against the Lakota and the Cheyenne in particular. So, yeah, I think those two events very much connect, including geographically. They're only about 100 miles apart.
Now, you also, you live in Montana now. You grew up in Wyoming, and I appreciated the back note where it said you were an interpretive guide at Fort Laramie. How many years did you do that for?
I did that for 3 summers in high school and college.
That's like a perfect summer job. I mean, was it fun at the time?
It was a blast. And I think as a growing up as a boy in Wyoming, you know, dressing up in a cavalry uniform, firing a cannon twice a day, marching around with the period rifles, all of that was baking bread in a wood-burning oven. It was a great summer job.
Did they pay you for that stuff?
You know, I think I started off as a volunteer and then got paid later on. So I guess I worked my way into the paid gig.
Well, what I appreciate a lot about Ridgeline is that you were able to authentically enter into the point of view of so many different people. Crazy Horse, obviously, the women of the fort, the soldiers in the fort, the variety of people in the fort, and this incident, Fetterman's Battle, which people may or may not know of, has evidently got quite a historical record, but not nearly enough to know what happened. Would you explain to people the historical record they will find if they go look up Fetterman's Battle, which I don't want them to do, but just so they get the fact that this is not made up?
Sure. It is absolutely not made up. It, as you mentioned, has this sprawling cast, very diverse cast, that includes, you know, the Lakota, the Cheyenne, the U.S. Army, the women who traveled out west with their husbands who were officers, the laundresses. And so it's got this sprawling cast. But the historical record, the great thing about it is the main kind of mileposts are there. We know that the cavalry and the infantry go over a ridgeline on a particular day. But there's a lot of mystery about the battle itself. And so it sort of made it perfect for historical fiction because there's a lot of things that we can speculate about, but we just don't know. And so those are the kind of the spaces that I tried to fill up with a novel.
Well, I always have a favorite major character and a favorite minor character. The major character is Crazy Horse, and I want to talk to you about him in a moment. But the minor character is your bugler, Adolf Metzger. And, my grandfather was the last man in America named Adolf. He was born in 1892. There just aren't any Adolfs left.
Right.
But I was unaware that the cavalry and the army out west was made up of many immigrants, many of them not even literate.
Well, most of them, in fact, were a lot of them were immigrants at the time, in part because for the German Americans, it was a way for them to learn English. And so they would sign up for a 2-year stint with the U.S. Army and learn English and kind of get paid to do it. There was a huge number of Irish Americans that were members of the U.S. Army in that era. So it's very much an immigrant army in the 1860s and 70s.
Now, is there any prototype for the bugler, or is that one of your inventions? I know Crazy Horse, the real deal with Crazy Horse, but is Bugler Metzger real or invented?
Bugler Metzger is absolutely real. In fact, his crumpled bugle is in a museum in Buffalo, Wyoming. You can go see it.
You see, I think that is really a remarkable bit of research. How long? Now, take me into the craft. Historical fiction, sure. If it's good, is great. If it's bad, it's terrible. Because you'll get bad ideas in your head, and they won't be true, and we'll never get them out. How did you research this to get it to the point where you are comfortable with people reading it and walking away with an account that they can rely on, not just on Jeopardy, but in conversation with friends?
Sure. Well, there's kind of two parts of it. I mean, first of all, obviously, I read everything that could be read about this incident and the people involved. I spent a lot of time walking the battlefield itself to get my own feel for how things might have happened. As I said, there's a lot of mystery, so you really do have to go there, and it's a wonderful, beautiful place in the Powder River Valley of Wyoming. But then, part of this for me really was incredibly that high school job I had, where for 3 summers I came about as close as you can come in modern life to experiencing what it would have been like to live in that era as a soldier, and dressing up in the same uniform that they wore, eating the food that they ate, firing the weapons that they fired. So all of those things kind of mixed together for me in a way that I hope makes the book feel real.
Oh, it feels so real. In fact, I think that it may be the best novel of the West since Lonesome Dove, and I enjoyed it. In fact, you've got a Lonesome Dove character here. Tell us about cowboy.
Well, Lonesome Dove has always been one of my favorites. And in fact, I was very honored to have Larry McMurtry endorse the book before he died. But the incident that Lonesome Dove is based on, the real life incident, is about a cowboy named Nelson Story, who drives a herd of cattle from Texas to Montana. He actually does that in real life in 1866, right in the middle of this war that is being fought that I write about. And so in real life, Nelson's story shows up in the middle of this. And, of course, that was catnip to me. I had to write about that and do as part of Ridgeline.
Nelson's story comes across. I did not know he was the basis of Lonesome Dove, and I've read it twice and I've watched it once. I didn't know it was based on a real cowboy. So that is a book within a book. Tell me a little bit about Native American point of view. When you were reenacting at Fort Laramie, had the awakening as to the Native American history in America begun? I mean, Little Big Man is of my youth, and it begins there with the Native American movement. Where was it when you were at Fort Laramie?
I would say that the U.S. government was not doing a very good job of interpreting Native American history at that time at all. And it's one of the things that was striking to me even then, is that the Native Americans were in many ways almost left out of the story. And when I wrote this book, I felt a huge sense of responsibility to try and tell that aspect, the Native American aspect of the story, and tell it well, and did a lot of work. Was lucky enough to have a number of Native American readers who gave me a lot of feedback on what I had written. I made a lot of changes to the book on the basis of that feedback that I hope improved it. But that was a responsibility I took very seriously.
Now, when you get down to actual battle tactics of Crazy Horse and the Sioux especially, but also the Cheyenne and the Arapaho, do you know those for a fact, how they fought, for example, on their horses with, grabbing a new repeating rifle and trying to figure it out? Is that all conjecture, or is that documented?
It's a mix. And you know, there is a decent amount written about that era and even that battle. But as I said, there really is a lot that we don't know, and so I did have to speculate, which was as a fiction writer is a lot of fun. But again, I hope that I did enough of my homework that even my speculation is inside the bounds of what historians would see and say that feels real.
You know, I encourage young people who cannot get through Plutarch or Livy to read Colleen McCullough's The First Man in Rome, because it's a great way to access the history. Then you can go back and read the real history. And you do list a number of serious historical works about the Native American battles with the American cavalry. Which is the best?
That's a tough question. There's a book that we used to read at Fort Laramie called 40 Miles a Day on Beans and Hay that I think is one of the best books kind of from the soldiers' perspective. There's a biography of Crazy Horse by a Native American writer named Marshall that I think is very good. His last name is Marshall. So those are two that I really like a lot.
40 Miles on Beans and Hay. I remember that. 40 Miles a Day on Beans and Hay. Now, another question I wrote down. At the same time I was reading Ridgeline, I'm listening to The British Are Coming, which is a history of 1775, 1776 that former President Bush recommended me on the air. And it's remarkable the amount that Native American tribes in both Canada and the United States had to play in the Revolutionary War. Have you studied only the Western tribes, or have you also studied the tribes of the Midwest and the Eastern Seaboard?
I have studied the Eastern tribes a little bit, but not nearly as much. I've always really been focused on Western American history. And so, you know, for me, a lot of my research kind of begins with Lewis and Clark going west and the encounters they had with the tribes as they went west. The Revenant, of course, was written about the fur trade era and specifically set in the 1820s. So my history is much better on the Western tribes.
You know, I love your scouts here, the old fur traders who get old. And then when I discover they're not made up, I just thought they were fictional. They're too perfect, right? They're just too perfect.
Well, that's the thing, again, as a writer, when I discovered that Jim Bridger, the King of the Mountain Men, and James Beckwith, this famous mixed race mountain man, were together in the middle of this story in real life, it was catnip as a writer.
I got to wonder, did you not have an awakening that, oh, my gosh, this is a gold field. I'm the first one here. There, you know, that's playing off of one of the backstories in Ridgeline, the Montana Gold Rush. But, my gosh, I'm the first person to do a historical novel on this sequence of events.
Well, there are other things that have been written over the years. But I did feel that there was a telling there that maybe I was in a good position to write, including – you know, given my background growing up in Wyoming and having experienced a bit of 1870s life. So I was very excited that there was this this opportunity there to hopefully bring the story to a wider audience.
Has Ridgeline been optioned for the movies?
It has been. It was it was optioned about 6 months ago by the same company called Anonymous Content that did the Revenant. So I'm very hopeful on that front.
Did you help on the screenplay for The Revenant?
I did only in small ways. I was working for the U.S. government at the time, so I was not able to have a side hustle. But I did, before I went to work for the U.S. government, consult on various versions of the screenplay.
Now, that is
one
of the most...
Some of my advice was taken and some was not.
The Revenant, a number one New York Times bestseller, and I think Ridgeline will be as well, because it is... Did you time it for Father's Day, Michael?
You know, my publisher was very much aware that Father's Day was out there, and I think they like you, hope that it will be something that people think of as a good gift for Father's Day.
I've gotten so many bad Father's Day gifts over the years that I'm just telling people, if you're thinking about it, this will work. Now, what what I found curious, I knew about The Revenant, of course. I hadn't read it, but I'd seen the movie and loved it. But I didn't know that you were the U.S. ambassador to the WTO for 8 years. And that makes you a Democrat, which is fine by me. I don't care what people's party are when it comes to historical fiction. But that is kind of a career jump, isn't it, to go from being the WTO ambassador and having The Revenant on one end and Ridgeline on the other?
Well, I have kind of an eclectic career background, I guess,
and
honestly, I've always had a couple of deep passions. One of them has been for Western history, and one of them has been for international affairs and international politics. And so, in my mind, they all kind of fit together. But I can understand why it's not necessarily a straight line.
How did President Obama come to find you to send you to Geneva?
Well, as a young person, I had worked in an earlier administration, and so I knew some of the people that were going into that administration who were working on trade issues, actually.
Now, wait, that's got to be Clinton. That's Mickey, right? And Dan Poneman and people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a bunch. I know all these bad Democrats who hang around and they got away. So how did you hook up with Mickey and all the USTR people?
So I had worked on Capitol Hill for Senator Baucus from Montana, and while working for Senator Baucus, then had the opportunity to go into to Mickey Cantor's office of the U.S. Trade Representative, and he, you know, became a mentor to me and has been my whole career. So Mickey's one of my favorite people.
He's a great lawyer and a fine American, but now you have to talk to our audience about how you managed to turn out not just The Revenant, but Ridgeline while pursuing politics in Montana, of all places.
Well, the answer is on lots of airplane rides. I love to write, which makes it easier to find time to do it. But I do a lot of writing early in the morning, a lot of writing on airplanes. I've written this in a lot of bad hotel lounges. And so definitely had to learn to write with other things going on in the background.
Now, Michael Punk, I see your son is in the business, like my son is in the business, because he followed me on Twitter when I started to tweet about your book. And I assume he's gone the way of all bad things, and he's a Democrat as well. Montana is now deep red. Are you still comfortable up there?
I am very much comfortable in Montana. Montana's a pretty eclectic state politically, including a whole bunch of independents. So there's a lot of tolerance for different political perspectives in Montana.
I just had Governor Gianforte on last week, and I have fished the Madison and Ennis a couple of times with my buddy Jan Janeiro. Well, not very well. The fish have nothing to be afraid of, and the guides do. Which part of the state are you in?
So I'm in Missoula.
Okay.
But I've fished the whole state, and including the Madison. But no, there's my favorite places to fish in Montana are mostly kind of smaller creeks. And for big rivers, I probably love the Yellowstone the best.
All right. Now I want to go back to a couple of historical details. And again, talking about a book without giving away anything is important. How many logisticians ended up in command in the West? Because there is this theme that he was a great quartermaster kind, the commanding officer here. But then they put him in command of warriors, and it doesn't work well. How often did that occur in the West?
You know, it's interesting because I don't think it happened that often. In part because there was such an abundance of really battle hardened veteran officers after the Civil War. And it's very strange that the officer that you're talking about, Colonel Carrington, who was the commanding officer of this group in the book, I think they picked him because they really foolishly thought that they weren't going to have to fight. What his main task was to go build a fort. And he was actually very good at building a fort. He would have been a very good mayor. He just was not a good combat leader. And so they sign a treaty, although they didn't even sign it with the tribes that lived in the land that was in question. And so they thought because of signing this treaty that they would enforce peace and that he would go out and build a fort. And then later on, they would kind of sends the kind of soldiers they needed at that fort to handle a more military environment. But he was picked for the wrong job, as opposed to the job that he was ended up having to do.
What was amazing about the end of this is, as I read your afternote about the two Mrs. Carringtons, and I won't say anything more about it, and their effort to salvage their husband's history. It's not unlike Alexander Hamilton's wife, the daughter of Senator and General Schuyler, who waged, I think, a 50-year campaign to get Hamilton his due. It sounds like the Carrington wives were just as relentless in telling their side of the story.
They were quite relentless, and Carrington spends the rest of his career after this incident kind of trying to blame other people for what happened, and he kind of somewhat shamelessly enlists his ultimately two wives in this endeavor. And he was quite successful for a long time, actually. I think the sort of Carrington version of history, which I don't think is accurate, is the one that prevailed for, you know, more than 100 years until a couple of, I think, more recent historians did some more digging.
Well, let me conclude by talking to you about Red Cloud and about Crazy Horse. I think Americans have generally the wrong idea of Crazy Horse, that he was a bandit. He's not. He's not Geronimo. He's a completely different character. How would you characterize his standing in the pantheon of American Native American heroes?
Well, he's been a huge hero of mine since I was a boy growing up in Wyoming. And I think one of the interesting there's an aura of mystery about Crazy Horse. He never allowed himself to be photographed, so we don't even know for sure kind of what he looked like. But I think one telling thing about Crazy Horse is his father was a spiritual leader, and his uncle was a warrior, and he really was dramatically influenced by both. And I think that combination of kind of spiritual leader and warrior is one of the things that makes him so interesting as a human being and as a leader.
Now, you're talking about Worm and High Backbone. And these names are, I assume, the authentic names from the record.
Yes, they are.
There isn't much about mothers in this culture and in this book. And there's a little bit, but not a lot. How much role do the mothers of the Native American big historical figures play? Do you know as much about them as you would, for example, about Worm and High Backbone?
There's less historical record, although certainly the mothers in Native American culture played enormous roles. Crazy Horse's mother died when he was young, and he was raised in significant part by when his father remarried. I don't think they refer to them as stepmothers, but essentially by his stepmother. So he had two very influential mothers in his life.
Now, the other one I want to talk about, and by the way, how do people end up with names in these three tribes' cultures? I'm sure they're different everywhere, but in the Lakota, in the Sioux, in the Cheyenne, and the Arapaho, how do people end up with names? You say at one point, I think I'm getting this right, Michael, that Worm gives Crazy Horse his own name. Am I recalling that correctly?
That's right. After Crazy Horse went out for his kind of boyhood vision, he comes back and relates his vision to his father. His father had originally been named Crazy Horse, and his father gives Crazy Horse, the character in my book, the name, his own name, and then as a sign of humility, takes the name of Worm, and as obviously a symbol of a humble creature. And actually, that humility is another thing that I think is very characteristic of Crazy Horse's life, and one of the things that makes him very compelling to me as a character.
What makes the most compelling character to me is Red Cloud. Now, I will freely admit, I didn't know anything about Red Cloud until I read Ridgeline. Zero, zip, nada. And so I am impressed at his diplomatic skills. Now, they obviously do not hold together, but is that unprecedented, what he pulled off?
In the Western tribes, it was unprecedented, and in fact, I think it's one of the reasons why Red Cloud wins this war. And it's, we don't think of Native Americans as winning wars, and they win this war. And as you say, we all know that later on it doesn't hold together. But for a period of years, they win back territory that had been seized by the U.S. Army. And as you say, a big part of that is because of the brilliance of Red Cloud's leadership. And he does something diplomatically, both diplomatically and militarily. Diplomatically, he creates this coalition of tribes, some of whom had not been particularly friendly to each other in the past. And then militarily, he creates a battle plan and a trap that was without precedent.
Who is your cartographer for the front piece, by the way? It's very well done.
Oh, for the map or for the drawing?
The map.
I don't remember the name of the cartographer, unfortunately. It's written down in there someplace, but it was the publisher helped pull that together. It's very well done.
It's really superb. I can't say this enough. Now I have to ask the obligatory author question. What's next?
Well, I'm not married to any one story yet, but what I'm always kind of looking for is, look, I love the history of the American West and especially the 19th century American West. So I'm always kind of poking around in that world. I want a combination of a really exciting adventure story, which I think is kind of at the core of Ridgeline, just as it was at the core of The Revenant. And in my perfect world, it's a story that I think has contemporary relevance and lessons, as I think this one does. For example, there's a lot in this book about, the leaders we follow and the consequences of bad leadership and the responsibility of people who are around leaders. So there's contemporary themes that to me come through, not in a beat you over the head kind of way, but they just kind of jump out of the story. And so I don't know yet is the short answer, but I'm always looking.
Well, I will continue. If you search your mind, you come up. I think there's a hole in the Great American Bookshelf that you would see Battle Cry of Freedom and maybe Team of Rivals in. And there are certainly Revolutionary War epics, both Hamilton, even now Grant gets his due in this majestic biography. But there isn't really a story of the settlers and the Native Americans that is sweeping and comprehensive. I just don't know of one that leaps off at the page that isn't political, but is in fact just historical, just a narrative. And if you come up with one, let me know what the name is, and I'll broadcast that to the audience. But in the meantime, Michael Punke, and it's spelled P-U-N-K-E, terrific work. Congratulations. I hope you're number one on the New York Times bestseller list, and I hope you'll come back and call me when you come to town. I'll buy you lunch.
That sounds great. Thanks so much for your interest. I really appreciate it.
And my pleasure, and thank you for Ridgeline. Thank you, America. Stay tuned for the next interview with Hugh Hewitt.
That concludes today's episode of The Interview with Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening. Make sure you come back and check out all the other podcasts on the Salem Podcast Network. And remember to thank our sponsors, andrewandtodd.com. If you believe in long-form interviews like I do, then do your real estate transactions with Andrew Del Rey and Todd Avakian. I've known both men for a long time. andrewandtodd.com. Go there, answer a couple of questions. They'll tell you what's best to do with your house, or call them at 888-888-1172. You'll be glad you did, and you'll be glad that you listened to the next episode of The Interview.